But I will try to substitute for him today as the chair of this session. The paper that is to be given at this session is entitled Plural Wives in the Mormon Marriage Market. The presenter of this paper is Dr. Catherine Danes. Dr. Danes received her bachelor's degree at DePauw University, her master's at Indiana University, and this last spring her PhD in history. All three of her degrees have been in history, and this last spring she received a PhD in history from the University of Indiana, Indiana University. She has previously taught at Indiana University as well as DePauw University, and currently she is turning her dissertation into a publication which will soon be forthcoming. The respondent to this paper is Craig Foster. Craig received his BA in history from BYU in 1986, his master's in British history in 1989, and a master's of library science from BYU in 1991. He most currently has been a research assistant for Marie Cornwall in the Women's Research Institute at BYU, but he informs me that that has currently ended and he is not at the Women's Research Institute at the moment. We will have 30 minutes for the presentation of the paper, following which Craig will have 15 minutes to respond to the paper, and after that, if there is time, we will have comments or questions from you. So we'll turn the time now to Catherine Danes for her paper, Plural Wives and the Mormon Marriage Market.
Much has been said and written about the percentage of Mormons involved in plural marriage in the 19th century, but little has been noted about the impact polygamy had upon those not directly involved in its practice. Yet, because plural marriage created a relative scarcity of marriageable women in the marriage market, the principle had an impact upon the age at which women married, the percentage of women who ever married, and opportunities for remarriage. This was so even though plural wives did not represent a cross-section of Mormon brides in the 19th century. Plural wives, that is, second or higher order wives, were disproportionately from economically disadvantaged groups, that is, those women who were widowed or divorced, or whose fathers were dead or not in Utah. These conclusions are based on my reconstitution of the 19th century residents of Manti and their marital histories. The database was created from a variety of sources, including all the available manuscript censuses for Manti, membership records of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, family group sheets, sextons records, marriage license records, the International Genealogical Index, the Endowment House record, and immigration indexes. Based on this database, this figure shows the relationship between the percentage of monogamous marriages among Manti women compared with the mean marriage age for monogamous women. Included in this graph are only those women who were in Utah by age 14, that is, only those who were subjected to the forces of the Mormon marriage market from the time that they were of marriageable age. As you can see, the two lines move roughly together. They both drop rapidly to their low point in 1856 and 57, and then they both rise slowly till 1890. The relatively large percentage of women entering plural marriage in the first 20 years of settlement, particularly in 1856 and 57, created a scarcity of marriageable women because men did not, or women did not significantly outnumber men. In this situation, men sought wives among increasingly younger wives, or younger women, thus intensifying the decline in women's mean age at marriage caused by the conditions on the frontier. The mean marriage age for monogamous wives reached its lowest point of 16 and a half years in 1857 during the Mormon Reformation. From 1860 to 1890, the mean marriage age rose at least 1 year each decade. From 1860 to 1870, it soared from 16.6 years to 18.7 years. By 1880, it had risen to age 20, and by 1890, had risen to just over 21 years. These mean ages at marriage are lower than for other 19th century groups in the United States. In Utah, both monogamous and plural wives in the Manti database married on average at about 16 and a half years in 1860. In comparison, women in Massachusetts in 1860 married at a mean age of 23.6 years, and women in Edgefield, South Carolina married for the first time at about age 20. In Kentucky, women married at about age 21 and a half years. Women in the Far West married at earlier ages, though not quite so young as did Mormons. Women in Western rural areas who married before 1900 did so at a mean age of 20 and a half years. By the turn of the century, when plural marriage was no longer officially sanctioned by the church, Mormon marriage patterns approached the national norms. Although the median marriage age of 21 and a half years for Manti women from 1890 to 1910 remained slightly below median ages at marriage for women in the coterminous United States. In short, average marriage age for women in Utah during the 19th century was considerably below the national average, owing to the presence of plural marriage. Both monogamous and plural wives were part of the same marriage market. Because the demand for wives was high, the mean marriage age for all women was suppressed, and it was suppressed to the greatest degree when the greatest percentage of first marriages were plural ones. Plural marriage also provided opportunities for all women to marry if they wished to do so. In the Manti database, of those women born before 1852, that is, those women who typically married before 1870, only one woman never married. And she was a Danish woman who immigrated in 1863 at age 26. In the early settlement period, less than 1% of the women in Manti remained single, whereas 7 to 8% of American women in the same birth cohorts never married. Of those Manti women born between 1852 and 1870, that is, those who typically married between 1870 and 1890, 2% remained single. This is still well below the 8 to 11% of other American women in similar cohorts. Among the Manti women born between 1870 and 1890, that is, those women who generally married after the manifesto, 5% never married. This was an increase over the first 40 years of settlement in Utah, but remained below the 9 to 11% of American women in the same birth cohorts who never married. The emphasis Mormon doctrine placed on marriage clearly influenced the marriage rate, keeping it high even after plural marriage essentially ceased to be a part of the Mormon marriage system. On the other hand, during the early years of settlement, when plural marriages were most common, the marriage rate was very high, above 99%. Plural marriage also provided opportunities for widowed and divorced women to remarry.
Had come from monogamous marriages, but slightly over half, 54%, married into plural marriages. We also see if we combine those who were first wives as well as plural wives, 62% of remarriages eventually became plural marriages. Of those who were plural wives, or initially, can see that 53% initially remarried as monogamous wives.
Two of these women who had been in plural marriage remarried into monogamy, found these marriages unsatisfactory, divorced their monogamous husbands, and remarried again as plural wives. Conversely, another woman found a satisfactory marriage in monogamy only after one monogamous and two polygamous marriages had ended in divorce. On the other hand, as you can see, almost as many former polygamous wives remarried into plurality as those who did not. And over their lifetimes, a majority of polygamous wives who remarried experienced another plural marriage. Not all women remarried, of course, but most young widowed or divorced women did so. Before 1888, only 35 of the 190 widowed or divorced women 45 years or younger in the Manti database have no record of remarriage. Apparently, because one of the major purposes of Mormon marriage was to bear children, older women tended to remarry less frequently. Of the 35 women who did not remarry, 40% were 40 years or older. But most women of childbearing age who had been widowed or divorced did remarry. Because the majority married as plural wives, it is apparent that the possibility of plural marriage presented opportunities for remarriage. Given that so many previously married women became plural wives, it's not surprising to find out that they counted
for so many of those who became plural wives. You can see
29.3% of the remarriages, or excuse me, of the plural marriages were by women who had been previously married. In addition, about one-third of plural marriages were by women whose fathers were dead or not in Utah, with another 4% being women who were over 30, but whose family situation is unknown and very likely belong to one of the first two groups. You combine these three groups together, the divorced or widowed, father not in Utah, and a woman over 30, comes to 65.6%, or almost two-thirds of plural marriages were made by these women. Such women were in general reliant upon their own economic resources. And often these economic resources were meager indeed. For example, Sophia Clown Peterson immigrated from Denmark at age 31 with five children. After she'd paid for the family's journey to Utah, she had a balance of only one Rigsdaler. She and her children pulled a handcart across the plains in the Willie Company in 1856, but the company left late in the season and was caught by snow in the mountains. 67 of the 500 in the company died before help arrived. As soon as Sophia and her children arrived in Utah, they were asked to go to Manti, and there the destitute family moved in with Albert and Rhoda Smith. Less than 3 months later, Sophia became the second wife of Albert. Like Sophia Peterson, Elizabeth Haydock, a 55-year-old widow, could not afford to buy a wagon and the animals to pull it, so she too traveled to Utah with a handcart. She was with the ill-fated Martin Company, which left even later in the season than had the Willie Company. Of the 576 people in that company, 135 died before rescue teams arrived. Elizabeth and her daughter survived, but Elizabeth lost an eye through exposure to the cold. A year after her arrival in Utah, she became the third wife of the Bishop of Manti. In the same company, Ann Larson lost her husband and two children before help arrived. She, too, became the plural wife of a Manti resident a year later. Women whose husbands died in Utah also found themselves in difficult financial circumstances. When William Fowler, who wrote the words to We Thank Thee, O God, for a Prophet, died in 1865, he left his wife Ellen with three young children. A daughter later wrote, "After father's death, mother had to work very hard at sewing, gleaning wheat, and teaching school 3 months of the school year. Still, we suffered from want of food and with the cold." Under such circumstances, it is not surprising that widows hoped that becoming plural wives would improve their lot. About 2 years after her husband's death, Ellen became the plural wife of William Bench. In general, polygamists were among the wealthiest men in the community. But if they suffered a reversal in their financial fortunes, the plural wives could find that plural marriage offered no greater economic security than being single. For example, Eunice Billings married John Warner in 1849 and was sealed to him 2 years later. They had four children, the last of whom was born after his father was killed by Indians at the start of the Walker War. 3 years later, in 1857, Eunice became the plural wife of George Washington Snow. In 1860, George Snow's wealth placed him in the top 30% of household heads in Manti. By 1870, however, his wealth had decreased 60%. Eunice, meantime, left Manti, moved in with her mother in Provo, and reassumed the name of her first husband. She continued to use the name Warner and to live separately from Snow until his first wife died 23 years later. Plural marriage did not always provide financial benefits for wives, as it did not for Eunice Warner, and this often resulted in separations or divorces. But for those wives whose husbands were wealthier and who did not suffer financial reverses, plural marriage could provide a measure of economic security. This was true not only for women who had been previously married, but also for those whose fathers had died or who were not in Utah. Most of those in the latter category were women who immigrated to Utah alone or with family members other than their fathers. For example, Maren Anderson joined the Mormon Church against the bitter opposition of her parents. Although a childhood illness had left her with an impaired left side, she moved from her parents' home, worked as a seamstress for 2 years, and by frugal living, was able to pay for her passage to Utah. At age 29, she arrived in Utah with no family or acquaintances and little money. The Jens Hansen family in Manti invited her to stay with them until other arrangements could be made. Such arrangements were made about a year later when she became Hansen's second wife. Eliza Lyons, at age 20, immigrated to Utah in 1863 with two other young English women. George Peacock, a polygamist returning from a mission in England, traveled across the plains in the same wagon train and ate in the same group. He asked Eliza to become his plural wife, and she accepted. Until arrangements could be made for the wedding, he went home to Manti. Before the wedding could take place, however, Eliza decided she preferred to become the plural wife of Peacock's brother-in-law, Isaac Groh. Within 5 months of her arrival, Eliza had at least two chances to become a plural wife. It seems that a woman willing to become a plural wife did not lack opportunities to marry. That women without families in Utah were thought particularly suitable to be plural wives is indicated by the Journal of Pretty Meeks. When his first wife told him in 1856 to marry a plural wife, he said he intended to get a handcart girl. Sister Free told him that she knew of a handcart girl who had no relations in Utah, and, quote, it would suit her the best kind, unquote. As it turned out, he chose not to marry that girl. But his account indicates that it was apparently conventional wisdom to take as plural wives women without relations in Utah. That almost one-third of plural wives had no fathers in Utah suggests this belief was widely accepted. Almost one-third of plural wives did, however, have fathers who did live in Utah at the time of their plural marriages. As you can see, 27.6% came from families where both parents were living, although the majority of these did come from households where plural marriage was practiced. In addition, 3.7% came from homes where the father was living and the mother was dead. Another 0.6% are women under 30 whose family circumstances are unknown, and then another 2.4% who've proven particularly difficult to trace. As you can see by this table, the large majority, over 70% of the women between 1848 and 1887, married as monogamous wives. Although plural wives accounted for only about one-fifth of women marrying for the first time in Utah, 41.4% of these women whose fathers were dead or not in Utah became plural wives. When first wives are added to that, 56.9% of fatherless women were in plural marriages. Clearly, women in this category disproportionately entered plural marriage. Of the 664 women included in this table, one-fourth had fathers who were in polygamy. Such women were accustomed to its practice and often received encouragement from their families to enter plural marriage. Nevertheless, as you can see, more than three times as many daughters of polygamists became monogamous wives as became either first or plural wives. Marriageable women whose fathers were monogamous but whose mothers had died were small in number, and the majority of these did become monogamous wives. Nevertheless, a disproportionate number became plural wives. And this was particularly the case when the father had remarried. The marriage of an older daughter removed her from a household where otherwise she might come into conflict with a new stepmother. Plural marriages could be accomplished expeditiously. The demand for plural wives appears to have always been greater than the supply, and plural marriages could be arranged and take place without lengthy courtships. The women least likely to enter plural marriage were those whose parents were monogamous and both were living. Monogamous parents in general produce monogamous daughters, here 85%. Of the 23 exceptions to this, those who became plural wives, six were women whose families had experienced the trials of Nauvoo and winter quarters, five came from families who had immigrated within 18 months of their marriages, three were from families who listed no wealth on the census or tax assessment rolls near the date of the marriage, and one had had an illegitimate child. Of all women whose fathers were dead or not in Utah, 63% were women who immigrated to Utah after their 14th birthdays, women whom I will call immigrants. Many of these, like Eliza Lyons, had left their families behind in Europe. Among those who were both fatherless and immigrants, 45% first married as plural wives, while 65% became either first or plural wives. This suggests the importance of immigration in fueling the pace of new plural marriages, although this is a perspective in contrast to the prevailing view argued by Stanley Ivins. In his article, Notes on Mormon Polygamy, which in one survey was voted as one of the two best articles ever written about Mormon history, Ivins indicated that new plural marriages were a reaction to internal and external crises. There are, however, two difficulties with this argument. First, 19th century Mormon history is sufficiently turbulent that almost any rise in the number of plural marriages may be explained by some crisis or other. Second, and more importantly, Ivins made a fundamental error when he did not evaluate the reliability of the sources on which he based his conclusions. Frank Esham's Pioneers and Prominent Men of Utah, one of the two sources Ivins used, is both incomplete and inaccurate. Of the polygamists in the Manti database, only one-third had individual entries in Esham's volume, and of those who did have entries, only one-half had the correct number of wives listed. One-third were listed with one wife only, even though the men were in fact in plural marriage. The other source Ivins used is even less complete and only slightly more accurate. Thus, not only Ivins' conclusions, but also the data on which he based those conclusions may justly be questioned. To be sure, immigration was not the only factor influencing the numbers of newly contracted plural marriages, but it was an important one. From 1848 to 1887, one-fifth of women in the Manti database who first married in Utah were women who immigrated after their 14th birthdays. 42% of these immigrants became plural wives. Immigrant women made up an even higher proportion of marriageable women in the first 20 years of settlement. 31% of women who first married in Utah then were immigrants. Of these early immigrants in the first 20 years, almost one-half became plural wives, while slightly more than two-thirds became either first or plural wives. This figure shows the comparison between the number of new plural marriages in the Manti database with the total number of foreign immigrants from 1842 to 1890. After 1852, the lines move roughly together, although the number of plural marriages decreases in relationship to the number of immigrants. That is what we would expect, given the decreasing percentage of immigrant women who became plural wives.
As you can see, in 1862, both lines rise, also in 1873. In 1858, both decrease, as do they in 1870. So there are corresponding points.
But more significant is the repeated pattern of peaks in marriages lagging a year or so behind increases in immigration. On average, before 1869, immigrants who married as plural wives did so 10 months after their arrival in Utah, while those after 1870 married as plural wives 20 months after their arrival. So a short lag time between peaks in immigration and marriage is what one would expect if immigration was fueling the pace of new plural marriages. As you can see, the highest point of foreign immigrants 1855 and 1856, while peak in marriages starts in 1856 and peaks in 1857. Also, in 1868, peak in immigration, 1869, peak in marriages. After 1870, there's a slightly greater lag time. 1878, you have peak in immigration. 1880, a peak of immigration in 1882, and a slight increase then in marriages in 83 and 84. The lines do not match perfectly, of course, because immigration was not the only factor affecting new plural marriages, but it clearly was an important factor. In summary, women did not randomly enter plural marriage, nor were they necessarily swept into it by reaction to crises affecting the Mormon community. Polygamous wives were drawn disproportionately from among those women who had been widowed or divorced, those who had no fathers in Utah, and those who'd immigrated to Utah after their 14th birthdays. Even so, all Mormon brides, the large majority of whom never experienced a plural marriage, were more or less affected by plural marriage in Mormon society. The age at which they married, the high percentage of women who in fact did marry, and their opportunities for remarriage should they become widowed or divorced, were all influenced by the presence of the principle in their midst. Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say that I realize that Catherine Dane's paper is the result of painstaking research. Having spent numerous hours going through census records myself, I am... century plural marriage was anything but consistent throughout the Mormon West, and that was in the incidence of Mormon polygamy in 1880, Dixie versus Davis Stake, which appeared in the Journal of Mormon History. I might also add that statistics, while necessary, can be very difficult to get a good reading on sometimes, for lack of better terms. For example, Vicki Burgess Olson, in her dissertation, gave the mean marriage ages of monogamous women as 19.8 years, and first plural wives at 20.7 years, while Jesse Embry in the Mormon Polygamous Families, Life in the Principle, listed the overwhelming majority of the 376 plural wives in her study as being in the 15 to 25 years range. That's quite a bit of difference between these three studies, and I don't want to attack any of them. I think they are all based upon very legitimate sources. It just depends upon who you're looking at. Now, according to Bennion's study, as I said, it differed greatly from one community to another. And while the statistics presented in this paper may describe the marriage market in Manti, they would not in Salt Lake City, nor would they for a small farming community such as Panaca, Nevada, I believe. And from all research that I have conducted of the Salt Lake City 13th and 20th wards, I can safely say that women married at a later age than the 16-year average for Manti women. It may not have been a lot, but it, from what I have found, it was definitely later. I believe that a lot of this would again have to do with economics and with urban versus rural communities. For example, Annie Elizabeth Heaps of Panaca, Nevada, where only 12 out of 264 people were in polygamy, was married at the age of 15 and eventually had around 10 children. Marriages at ages 15 to 17 were not uncommon for Panaca. My wife's family is from Panaca, and since she's related to the whole community practically, I was able to look at the genealogy records and find that. These marriages were not, however, influenced by the practice of plural marriage within the community, since such a small amount of people within the community marriage. Suzanne's, my wife's grandmother, who grew up, was born in the early 1900s, remembered that only one family at that time was even married polygamously. After reading this paper, I was not only left with concerns, some of which I have already addressed, but also with questions. Can a small farming community such as Manti truly give us representative statistics for plural marriage throughout the Mormon West? Did divorced and widowed women really have that much in common with women who do not have a father living in Utah? Did either of these two categories automatically place women into the situation of being economically disadvantaged? Why were women without families in Utah considered particularly suitable to be plural wives? Was it because they needed economic assistance in order to survive, Or are we to believe that they were perhaps defenseless victims of Mormon men? The reason why I ask this is because as the paper is written, we are truly left to wonder. No explanation is given. Also, what about internal and external factors such as the Mormon Reformation and reaction to persecution? These factors cannot be excluded altogether. I agree very much that they were a part and that there are other factors such as immigration that that led people or pushed people into plural marriage. But these cannot be excluded. And I think that I believe the journal entries and personal histories of these men and women who did practice plural marriage would be an adequate argument against that idea. And finally, what about faith? These people believed in the divinity of the doctrine that was taught them by their leaders. And because of that belief, I cannot help but believe myself that faith was a great factor. That these people did feel that it was necessary for their salvation, for their family's salvation, for whatever they were doing, kingdom building, whatever it was, they felt through the doctrines that they had been taught that they must practice plural marriage. I remember looking at the history of my own great-grandmother, who came from England, actually fit very well into what you had stated. She came from England and about half a year later married polygamously. But the reason why she did was because she felt, even though she felt very uncomfortable with the practice, she felt that that was what God wanted her to do. And that was the main reason why she entered into plural marriage. Now, although most of my comments appear to be somewhat negative, I want to say that I believe that this is a very good paper. And I believe that some of the things that have been brought out are extremely important and, as I said, do add new light to understanding plural marriage as it was practiced in the 19th century. I believe, however, that more explanation must be given as to the whys for some of these statistics. In other words, add a little bit more flesh. But as I said in general, I think that this was a very interesting and well done paper. Thank you.
Dr. Daines has suggested that we have comments or questions, and then she will also respond to the comments of Craig Foster. Yes?
The point that the reason that these women, one of the main reasons these women entered into plural marriage was because of the faith, I'm sure that's the case, but I wanted to ask Dr. Daines if she'd help us with that. That's kind of one of the read-between-the-lines implications of the paper, that perhaps the economically disadvantaged had a more childlike faith or had more willing to accept, you know, on faith value, so to speak, face value, so to speak, but, you know, on faith or the principle than most that weren't so desperate.
Question has to do with... did those who entered into plural marriage have a childlike faith, and because of that...
did they have a childlike faith because they were economically disadvantaged?
Did they have a childlike faith because they were economically disadvantaged?
I'm not sure I'd put it as a childlike faith. What I'm trying to get at here is the fact that many people professed a belief in plural marriage, but never practiced it. And why did some people practice it, and why did some people not? Surely those women who entered plural marriage did believe in it. But they also had a second reason, it appears, that from looking at a group, and instead of just taking people who... you could readily find, as many studies have done, I've done, is tried to find all the plural wives and then trace their histories so that we get more representative kind of sample of women who went into plural marriage. And of those people not only had the faith to go into it or believed in it, but they had another reason to go into it, at least two-thirds of them. There were the third, of course, who wouldn't have that economic reason to go into plural marriage.
In case that isn't... Can you repeat the question?
Okay, she's asking if there were more men, more single men, would there have been less plural marriage? I would say to some degree that might have been the case. I did not give in the paper, but it appears as though by the 1880s, if you look at numbers, compare men versus women who had their endowments, there were more men in relationship to women in 1880 who had had their endowments than earlier. And so what you're not looking at is just numbers of single men who are in Utah, but numbers of men who were considered worthy that you could be sealed to that person. And by the 1880s, there seems to be a slight increase in numbers of men who were able to go through the temple. And so we can't just look at a ratio between men and women, because obviously there were many soldiers, many miners who had come into Utah, and women were counseled not to marry those men. She's asking, did these women come then for that reason? I found no indication that they came expecting necessarily that they would have a plural marriage. But apparently, many of them came not opposed to such a marriage when opportunity came. Yes, I did a study on divorce, and if you take all the plural wives, or first and plural wives, about 17% ended in divorce. If you look at women who were just plural wives, not first wives, it increases to about one quarter of the marriages ended in divorce. So it was easy to get out of a plural marriage that was unsatisfactory, but as you recall, majority of those who left a plural marriage again remarried at some point in their lives as a plural wife. So it wasn't plural marriage that they were rejecting as much as this particular marriage. You mean number of divorces? Or he's asking, how do you compare polygamous divorces with monogamous divorces? Certainly the monogamous divorces were considerably fewer in number. It's harder to trace those people and get the same kind of data that I had for the plural wives. But it's considerably less. Yeah, but I should say that divorce in 19th century Utah was fairly accessible to monogamous as well as polygamists. Yeah. Yes. There were more monogamous marriages than polygamous marriages. It appears that way. And it depends on the groups you're comparing. The groups that I compared in that first graph were only those women who were unmarried and were in the marriage market in Utah from age 14. That does not include women who immigrated at age 16. So we're simply looking at women who are in the marriage market. But when you take women who are married and immigrate with their families, their husbands, and the families never involved in a plural marriage, you have many of those kinds of women who are not included in that kind of a statistic. So in Manti, the greatest number of women who were in plural marriage were in 1860, but Ben Bennion says that in Beaver in 1870 that was the case. So it varied from place to place. Is that okay? Yes. My analysis thus far has only been rudimentary. She asked if, since Manti had a considerable number of Scandinavians, did more Scandinavians go into plural marriage, and were there cross marriages? There were some cross marriages, to be sure, but one group tended to marry within its group. That certainly wasn't true all the time. And one of the story I gave about Albert Smith, who was an American whose plural wife, Sophia, was from Denmark. So there were obviously times when there were these intergroup marriages. In Manti, there tended to be more Scandinavians who went into plural marriage than Americans, mainly because those were the kinds of women who tended to be coming in without fathers, or but if you those women whose fathers died, say, as they're coming across the plains, those women tend also to be involved in plural marriages. Not always, but there was a tendency that way.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. He's asking if women left the church and over plural marriage. Is that correct? There were a few who did, but I should also say that there were two or three polygamists who also left the church. So it wasn't just plural wives, and they did so not necessarily over plural marriage. They could become disaffected over other kinds of things also. But it was seems to be a very low number who became disaffected over plural marriage, because it was fairly easy, if one was unhappy in a plural marriage, to leave that plural marriage and then contract a monogamous marriage, for example, just as long as there were a man who was not married at the time. It was much easier, of course, to marry into polygamy because you didn't have to worry about the assortive mating. Okay, the question is, as I understand it, were there more young women who came as immigrants than young men, so that there was a kind of imbalance in the sex ratio? There appears to be just a slight number of women, extra women, who came over young men, but it would be very small. The difference was when they came, if a woman was economically disadvantaged, if she came with very little money, what does she do to take care of herself? Well, you could become a domestic servant or teach school, especially in the early years. Those were your options. In later years, the options increased and you have fewer plural marriages. But in the early years, when those are your options, being a plural wife was considered a better alternative than being a domestic servant. For the young man who came, he usually was not in a position to marry immediately because he didn't have the economic wherewithal. So that even if the same numbers came of each sex, that they're not equally ready to marry when they arrive. And so for a young woman then, it would be to her advantage, especially if there were economic problems, to marry into plural marriage rather than wait for a young man to finally make his stake and to gain the economic resources in order to marry.
Wives?
He's asking if young men found themselves in competition with older men for wives. I think this was particularly so in the first decade or so, when there were a great number of plural marriages. And yet, a young man who had the wherewithal to marry seemed not to have difficulty marrying, because it appears as though monogamous marriage was preferable for most women. And so young men, I found no indication that young men found difficulty finding a wife because of that competition. Rather, the opposite, that the older men found difficulty finding plural wives, as many as they wanted. I think there was a much greater demand than a supply for plural wives. Yes.
What do you mean by that?
He's asking, what do we mean by belief in plural marriage? That's difficult to say because so many of these women did not leave journals, and particularly those women who came from the economically disadvantaged groups tended not to leave accounts. Hence, so many of the studies in the past who've relied upon those accounts are come from women who have either come from families where the father was a polygamist or whatever. What did they... It's unclear, and I'm not sure that they always knew what they meant by a belief in plural marriage. When they articulated these things, very often they were very brief, just that they believed in the principle, they believed that this is what God wanted them to do. But in terms of a long theological kind of exegesis and explaining themselves, very rarely do you find that kind of real questioning.
Cool. It's a thing to do in our society or whatever.
Okay. he's asking, did people go into plural marriage because they believed they needed to do this in order to achieve the highest degree in the celestial kingdom? Going through sermons in Manti, there seem to be some discrepancies between beliefs. And you get at sometimes people who would say, if you don't go into plural marriage, you can never achieve the highest degree. And not very long after that, you might find another person who gets up and says that this is the highest form of marriage, but it is not necessarily mandatory for everyone to go into plural marriage in order to achieve the highest degree. So there seemed to be some question in Manti whether that was absolutely necessary. It was certainly preferable, you got that idea from the sermons, but not necessarily that you absolutely had to, because there were obviously some good people in Manti. One man, for example, who was lame, a very good man, but it was just obvious economically he could not support other wives. So to condemn this person to some lower degree because he could not enter plural marriage, I think mitigated some of that idea that you absolutely had to be in plural marriage. I think it was more an idea, if you can be in plural marriage and if you individually are asked to go in marriage, then you should do so, but not necessarily everyone had to.
I'm sorry that our time is up because I can see that many of you have further questions. Dr. Danes has indicated that she would be here if you want to come up and ask your questions or discuss this paper with her. We would like to thank her very much for the efforts and the insights of this paper, as well as Craig Foster for the response comments. Thank you.